Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Vince Valentini, the telecom and media analyst at TD Securities. I'm thrilled to see all these faces live and in person after 2 years of hosting this event virtual, as I'm sure many of you have done with the vast majority of your events in the past couple of years. So I know there's still a lot of people choosing to do it via webcast versus coming live, but at least to see some of you here and your friendly faces is fantastic. So we are I'm not going to have any big opening and talk about the sector or anything. We're just going to jump right in, starting with the biggest, as we usually do at our conference, with BCE, the largest communications company in Canada. And we're thrilled to have Glen LeBlanc with us, their Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. So, Glen, great to see you in person, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, Vince. It is great to be at an event in person. This is my first one in 2 years. We're just starting to ramp up, as you folks are, so it's great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Of course. So at most of these conferences, including yesterday when Mirko spoke, the dividend always seems to come up late. I'm just going to start with the dividend because I think it's a critical piece of the investment thesis for BCE. So you've had this elevated CapEx for a couple of years. There's now talk about that coming down gradually starting next year, but not a big drop all the way back down to the $4 billion level you used to be at. When you look at that runway for free cash flow growth, I know you commit to at least raising the dividend 5%, but should we start to think about 2025 and beyond that there could be even the potential for even greater than 5% dividend growth, given what the free cash flow profile seems to be trending towards?
Yeah, it's an obvious question, Vince, and let me start with this. We are very focused on our dividend growth model at BCE, which has been proven by our track record of consistent and regular dividend increases. And when we think about our strategic plan of the next 3 years, we are pretty excited about what it holds for us. First, let me start with free cash flow opportunities. Finally, we find ourselves in a surplus position with our pension, which will save us in the vicinity of $200 million a year in current service costs, pension contributions. Over a 5-year window, I mean, we're talking about $1 billion of incremental cash flow that we didn't have in our 3-year strategic plan only a number of years ago. We took advantage of this difficult time, this pandemic we found ourselves in, and we said, well, what's the best thing we can do for our stakeholders? And that is advance fiber. There's no longer a question whether fiber works. We have that. There's no longer a question about the return on investment on fiber. So the only thing left for us was how fast can we efficiently and effectively deploy. So we're pretty excited now that we see a vision by 2025 of having 10 million fiber connections or homes passed, homes and businesses passed by 2025. So as you alluded to, we're going to start to see a gradual 2022 will be the high watermark for our capital program, and we'll start to see a gradual decline in that program through 2023, 2024, and 2025. And it will not only be what I'll call, for all intents and purposes, the completion of your fiber build, but it also will be the deployment of our 5G. So we can see a window or in the not too distant future that we will get back to a 15%-16% capital intensity. You alluded to the number a moment ago. That's roughly call it $4 billion-ish, which is $1 billion less capital than we're currently spending. So you add the pension opportunity that's in front of us. You add the fact that we have $1 billion less in capital on the horizon, the efficiencies that we continue to mine out of the business, and including one day the benefits of copper decommissioning. And you start to get yourself into a mindset that there's $1.5 billion of available cash flow in the not too distant future. Now, the difficult question that you asked, Vince, is what do you do with that? Will the board make a decision that we want to increase our dividend payout model from the historic approximately 5% to something higher than that? Do you do share buybacks? That's left for the board. But I will tell you one thing. When we generate that much incremental free cash flow, it makes for easy decisions because we have lots of places to deploy, and I think we've got a proven track record of wanting to reward shareholders.
A nice problem to have.
It's a great problem to have.
The question that will always come up then is, with that much excess cash and with the longer term history of acquisition driven growth, there hasn't been too much recently of scale. Is there anything you could see that would use up some of that cash flow in the next 2 or 3 years? You know, I'm not talking about $50 million or $100 million acquisition, but anything on the larger size that's even possible?
Well, you're right. That's what it's been in the last few years, is these small little tuck-ins, whether it be, you know, Enveronics and advancing our data mining strategy, or whether it be eBox. But, you know, when you look across the country and sticking inside of our kind of our knitting and the industry, there's not a lot available for further consolidation. Consolidation in the industry appears to be relatively challenging right now. So, you know, I don't know whether there'd be a lot. That said, I think if properties became available, government-owned entities in this country, we would absolutely be there to see what type of opportunity that gave us to expand our business.
But just to be clear, like, Glenn, moving outside of Canada is still something that would not be considered?
We have a sizable investment we want to make in this country right now to build fiber, to build our 5G networks, and invest in other facets of our business, so it is not something we're actively pursuing.
Okay. And I'm going to get into the individual business segments in a minute, but just a big picture level commentary from you, I mean, obviously very topical for the markets these days, is both inflation and supply chain issues. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of any headwinds, and maybe you can link that up to your guidance of 2-5% EBITDA growth for the year, which you maintained, even though you did 6.4% in the first quarter. Is there something in that macro sort of turmoil that is maybe scaring you a little bit?
Yeah, well, let's start with the tail end of your question first. We generated 6.4% EBITDA in Q1, but that had a one-time retroactive adjustment to a BDU agreement in our Bell Media business. That was approximately $70 million, and on the call that we had recently, I normalized for that, and I said that our normalized earnings was around 3.5%. So 3.5% is basically the midpoint of our 2-5 guidance. So there's not much to read into why we didn't expand the guidance, other than it was a one-time event that obviously is not going to repeat. But on your points about inflation and supply chain, yeah, it's been challenging. Supply chain, particularly with our enterprise customers. We would have started the year having some concerns that we would have product constraints in the first half of 2022, and I would say now we're less optimistic that it's not going to be all of 2022, and I think that's now the good news is we're not losing deals, we're not losing business, we're not losing market share, because everybody's in the same boat. What we're challenged with is projects managed. It could be a managed services project. They're being delayed because of the lack of product. So our enterprise customers are pushing these projects well out into the back half of 22 and into 2023. So that bodes well for growth in the future, because the funnel is continuing to remain. But it's been a challenge, and I think we're going to be faced with that headwind throughout the calendar year. Inflation, I would say we do a pretty good job of managing that for the most part. Long-term contracts that we have in place, we're not facing any supply chain challenges with the long-term contracts we have with our 5G equipment that we're deploying or our fiber equipment. You know, there is some areas, labor and energy would be probably the biggest challenge as we continue to seek, like all organizations do, to retain and attract new talent. We're finding that labor rates are absolutely increasing. And the other area that it's pretty obvious for our business is just the amount of trucks we have on the road and the state of fuel prices. I mean, that alone, Vince, will probably be a $15 to $20 million 2022 pressure that I wouldn't have envisioned in October or November. So, inflation manageable. I wouldn't call that the reason why we didn't expand our driver. I think the main driver for why we didn't expand our guidance. It's more about the retro adjustment that I alluded to.
Good color. Thank you. You mentioned the troubles with consolidation in Canada right now. So let me ask, I know it's not your deal, but just get your perspectives if you have any on, is there any potential remedy and potential new owner of Shaw's wireless assets that could scare you more than somebody else?
No, I mean, the real short answer to this is we've had a fourth wireless player in most of the markets we've operated for some time, Vince. Whether that be in Atlantic Canada and operating against Eastlink, or in Quebec and the competitive landscape created there by Videotron, or more recently, you know, Shaw in Ontario and out west, we've learned to compete, and I think our results would speak for themselves that we've done so quite effectively across this country. I think a new competitor that enters the market will actually not be as strong as Shaw in the West, with the potentially the lack of bundling opportunities that would exist. And we all know that that's an area this industry is working really hard on chasing, is that whole home customer. So I think whoever it is will compete. I think they'll have their own degree of challenges, potentially even a stretched balance sheet. Could be a challenge for a new competitor that enters into the business. So for us right now, it's head down, continue to doing what we're doing and servicing the customer better. And whoever it is, so be it.
You mentioned the balance sheet challenges potentially for the new player. I mean, the issue that often comes up is just network investment, both on the spectrum side as well as CapEx. Especially as you move into 5G and the densification of wireless networks that's required to do 5G properly. Does that mean that, is there a type of deal that scares you as opposed to a particular buyer? If you saw full-out network sharing, for example, would that be something that would raise a few red flags around the bell hallways?
I don't know if I would say raise red flags per se. It's probably something that has been a competitive advantage for us over the last number of years with our network sharing agreement with TELUS. And I think it's allowed us to acquire spectrum individually and contribute it to the agreement. If a new party enters as a fourth wireless player in this country and they don't have a network sharing agreement, then they're going to have to negotiate access rates, and it can certainly challenge the business. So I guess I don't know if I would call it red flags, Vince, but there would probably be a direction which I would lean, and that would be to continue to have the network sharing advantage that we have in this country right now with TELUS.
I suppose you don't want to comment on the terms of your network sharing deal with TELUS and the ability to bring a third party in?
Yeah, no. I know there were some things in the media and that we were not involved in those discussions. And suffice to say that we have an incredible network sharing agreement with TELUS, and it served both our shareholders extremely well. And any addition to a third party to that agreement would be a conversation that would be required by both parties.
Fair enough. So let's move on to your segments. Let's start with wireline, your bigger segment, obviously. Internet revenue has been quite impressive. Recently up 8% in Q1. Can you break that down for us between sort of subscribers and ARPU or pricing contributions?
Yeah, you're right. We're very pleased with our internet growth, and it really comes from four sources for us, four drivers. The first is the aggressive footprint expansion we're doing is the obvious one. As we continue to roll out fiber at the pace we are, we're enjoying the market share that we gain quickly in a new market. And that could be taking from competitors or it could be a market that has been grossly underserved for years and people are just excited to get off of, ATM or slow connectivity internet. The second area is the obvious one, is that when we roll out fiber, we tend to take share for a number of years post. So we're still seeing that experience of the fiber that we put in the last decade, last 5 years in particular, that we're migrating share every quarter, every month. So that's, kind of the second growth driver. Tearing up would be the third, as we can roll out fiber and we have faster speeds available, symmetrical speeds available, that we're upselling customers all the time. And the demands for bandwidth in the home, they're not slowing. matter of fact, if anything, I think the pandemic would have accelerated the demand for bandwidth in the home. Here we were all at home working with potentially two adults and a couple children and trying to do studies and video and gaming. And I think the demands for internet bandwidth have really grown, and that, you know, that serves Bell better than anybody in this country, because we have the largest fiber network, or we're on pace to get to 10 million, and we have the ability. Fiber has the ability to deliver symmetrical speeds. We're now offering 3 gig up and down, and no cable company can offer that upload speed. So I think the growth is still there. And then the final piece is, when you're rolling out products that are superior, you're able to improve the customer experience, then you do have pricing power. And the industry has moved to increase prices by tiers. So those four areas, Vince, are fueling the growth, and I don't think you're seeing an end to them anytime soon.
You mentioned the 3 gig. I'm curious about that. First off, do you see many people actually take the 3 gig service, and is there actually products or services that are available that a consumer could possibly use 3 gig symmetrical speeds right now?
Well, being around for a long time, as you have been, I can remember having conversations that in 2005 that, you know, 5 to 7 meg was plenty, and we had visions in our strategic plan of how we could get to 25 meg to the home. And I can literally remember discussions in the executive saying, that's boardroom, that, you know, that's crazy. No one can consume 25 meg. Within 2 years, we were having completely different discussions in the boardroom that it was inadequate and it would not meet the needs, the growing needs of the consumer. And I think, Vince, 3 sounds like overkill today. Certainly, it's more than enough. But I don't think we'll be saying that in 3 to 5 years' time when we're sitting here. We're working on 10G PON now, and that is a reality of what's going to be available to the home. We think about the number of connected devices in the home. It's everything now in your home is connected. And it's not just the 4 people who are working from home or gaming. It's your doorbell. It's your video cameras. It's your refrigerator. It's your smart TV. It just continues to go on and on and on. So I think this is one of those things that when you have network superiority, you lean into it, Vince, and that's what we're doing. We're leaning into something that I think ultimately consumers will want, and more importantly, our cable competitors can't deliver.
Can you mention the pricing power in your prior answer? Can you just ask about the internet resellers? It's been in the newspaper again as this deadline for the CRTC appeal process comes up. Has there been any evidence of, you know, resurgence of life for internet resellers? They all complained that it was the rate decision from the CRTC that killed them, but it seemed that the pandemic was equally a cause of that, as they just didn't have enough of a business model to handle that kind of surge in usage when they had a variable rate model. But for whatever reason it is that they've fallen off the wayside, is that permanent in your mind, or you see any evidence that they're coming back?
Well, I wouldn't say I see evidence, and I would be reluctant to ever use the word permanent, because we know how quickly regulation can swing. The relationship with the regulator may be as healthy as it's been in some time. I think the pandemic demonstrated to Canadians and demonstrated to the regulators just the importance of full connectivity in this country, and we are global leaders in that. We have to make sure we don't make policy decisions that stifle the investment. I think Canada was put on the map for the ability to allow Canadians to work from home. I think the governments are making a very aggressive push for rural connectivity and partnering with the large players, mainly in this country. So I would say, Vince, no signs, but reluctant to say it won't rear its ugly head one day. But I think most important, and the message we leave with regulators, is we've got a long road ahead to a connected Canada. Let's not make decisions that ultimately stop that growth and connectivity.
Do you mind if I just get you to clarify something for while you're on stage here for the audience? Because, you know, I think there are some people from the U.S. and maybe other markets who aren't fully aware of our regulatory system. Even though the internet resellers are not seemingly thriving today, the rules are still there. If anybody wants
to offer broadband and they don't own a network in any particular region, they can just demand access to your network or Rogers' network or another cable company's network and do that if they want. Is that correct?
But the arbitrage opportunity is not there now because the access rates are too high. So is their complaint. They'll say that they can't pay the network owners the fees that are currently in place and then still make a profit over the retail rate or the, so our argument is that these networks have cost us billions and billions to build. And that's why the rates need to be high, because you can't have somebody ride your rails for nothing. Or that will stifle investment in the long run in this country. And that's the biggest argument that continues to be in place. And I think it's proven out, whether it be ourselves or whether it be cable companies or in this country, we are continuing to invest. We're continuing to partner with governments in rural areas. And Canada is, as I said a moment ago, is a global leader. And we better be eyes wide open of how that can change if we can't make an adequate return. If somebody's riding our rails for free, then we have no choice but to stop constructing.
But to be clear, if somebody was willing to ride on your rails and make no profit margin, basically just break even, maybe let's say they had some bundling ambitions and they just wanted broadband in the bundle for a strategic reason, even if it wasn't profit driven.
Yeah, I mean, there is access rules. That's correct.
Okay. So the fiber you mentioned, I think I'm not going to ask again because I think it's been articulated many times by yourselves and the Western Canadian telco, just how great the fiber benefits are in terms of performance and OPEX. But can I ask again about the cost or monetization opportunities for some of the legacy assets once you finally do make a full move to fiber? I know Merkel was asked yesterday, it was kind of premature, but I'll ask you anyway, is there anything you can see in terms of the value of copper decommissioning and reselling the copper, reselling some of the real estate for all of your central office locations throughout the country?
I mean, this is inevitable, Vince. This isn't a question of if, this is a question of when. Now, I know we've been talking about copper decommissioning for far too long, and we have very little to talk about to this day. And it's quite elusive to get to that state because you have to force migrate customers. Well, we're in our fiber footprint now, 91% of our customers are on fiber, meaning 9% find themselves on legacy. Can we start to now go CO by CO and test force migration onto copper? So the answer is yes, we're doing that in 2022. And then what does that mean? That means ultimately, CO by CO, you start to have no consumer customers on your network. So does that mean you can shut down copper in its entirety? Maybe not, because you could have enterprise or business customers in that same area that warrant migration. And enterprise is even more challenging than migrating a consumer customer. So I think we're on the precipice of something very exciting. It is absolutely going to happen that this industry will figure out copper decommissioning. We'll start out with a CO by CO, but it's probably a little early to think that there'll be sizable savings delivered in 22 or even Vince 23. I think this is part of our 3-year roadmap. When I think about what's ahead of us for 3 years, I think about what I said earlier, completion of, for all intents and purposes, of the fiber 10 million connections and completion of 5G rollout. And then you start saying, well, now you should be able to start mining costs at a decommissioning. So they all kind of come together in that 3-year window, which is pretty exciting, being in the industry as long as you and I mean, fiber has been a journey for 12 to 15 years, and now you're finally able to do a strategic plan that's 3 years in duration and almost see the end.
Yes, it's been a long time coming, I admit.
It's rebuilding of a 140-year-old copper network is what it is, and that's the way we have to think about it. And to think that we are now inside a short window that we will actually see the end of that network replacement. Again, there'll still be rural areas that won't get there, but for the most part, our urban centers will be complete.
I don't think anybody in this room or on the line would dispute that the outlook for your consumer business is pretty attractive given this fiber future, plus the
scale and brand name and all the attributes that Bell has. But I think there would be a much bigger debate in the audience about your business telecom segment. Can you try to unpack that a little bit for us? We don't get disclosure every quarter, but I think you're willing on occasion to give some rough idea of exposure to enterprise versus SMB versus wholesale that you might include in business. So maybe if we can start with just a segmentation question, then maybe I'll follow up on the trends in that business.
Well, okay. Well, our business segment represents about 40% of our wireline revenues. And of that 40%, about three quarters of that is enterprise, and about a quarter of that 40% is small and medium business. Small business has been challenged, to say the least, during this pandemic, but we are seeing signs of recovery. We are, you see it in your own lives, where the dry cleaners are opening and the restaurants are opening and you're starting to see people moving around again. And our small business revenue is starting to rebound, and we're seeing healthy signs there. So I think over the next 18, 24 months, we'll see just normal economic recovery in a segment that was really challenged through the pandemic. Enterprise, Vince, is much more about investment in the future. It's about investments in products and services that our enterprise customers are going to need in the future. And that is why we're spending so much money on the convergence of 5G and fiber connections, security, IoT, the deals we made with hyperscalers around cloud, MEC, 5G MEC. So it's the investments in the next generation of products and services that our enterprise customers are going to need. So when I think about the headwinds that we face, and I hear you loud and clear in the enterprise space and where there's a reluctance or a concern, you know, I want to flip that around, because I believe that yes, there is going to be legacy connectivity pressure, but I think the opportunities for new service growth are going to be greater in the next 3 years than that headwind challenge. So I think it's, we're in a period of time of a shift where we have to be selling new products and services to our enterprise customers. And yes, it's early. You know, IoT is not too early. We get 9-digit revenue out of IoT now, but you know, MEC is early, still early days for cloud. So, but I think, Vince, in the next 3 years, we're going to start to see that represent a pretty sizable portion of our enterprise segment and more than offset those legacy connectivity declines.
You're making a good answer and a good segue into your wireless segment. But let me see if I can try to put words into your mouth. Is you're probably going to lose wireline B2B revenue in enterprise, but you would at least replace that, if not more, with mobility 5G services that are new things you can create for the enterprise market. So on a net basis, BCE gains, but there may be a bit of a shift from one division to the other?
Yeah, well, you're onto an interesting topic. Maybe it's been overused as well. We talked about decommissioning for 10 years, but we've talked about network convergence for 10 years as well. And I think finally you're starting to see the convergence of 5G and the blurring of the line about whether it's a wireline network or a wireless network. And to be honest, I don't care. I just want the revenue from the customer, and we want to deliver on their growth aspirations and partner with them. So I think you're right, Vince. There's a real blur here that's starting to take place.
Thank you. I was going to start with consumer wireless, but we've been talking about business, so let's stick with 5G and MEC and so forth. Is there any updates you can provide on new tangible contracts that you've signed or discussions that are in place with large sort of enterprise customers on any of these new solutions, and also anything new on in terms of the partnership model with the cloud companies as to who, what you keep, what they keep, and how those partnerships are working so far?
Yeah, I'm not going to disclose that, but obviously it is very early days. We just signed the Halifax port up to a private network agreement, which is, you know, that's right up our alley. That's what we should be able to do. So there's some new opportunities coming there. you know, products that we have in place, like tank monitoring, for example. How many IoT devices are going to be connected to this network in time is, you know, is incredible to think of. And you know, you can take a business like a propane delivery company, or maybe it's a trash collection company, and if they can monitor tanks remotely so that you're not rolling trucks into a neighborhood to your host, Vince, to find out you only needed 10 liters of propane versus 200, then they can change the entire delivery model that they have in their business. And that's going to be true for tank management, for waste collection. They know the weight of that garbage collection. They don't have to send a truck until it's full. So I think we're just on the early days of starting to see all of these connected devices. But no one is better positioned than BC to capture that revenue. We have the networks. So for us, we have the relationships with the enterprise customers, being the largest provider of enterprise connectivity services in Canada for decades. So now the challenge for us is to continue to make the investments and the partnerships like we did with AWS or Google so that we can offer a broader suite of services in emerging technologies.
Great. Back to consumer wireless. I hate to repeat something that Mirko talked about yesterday, but I think it's just so important as a differentiator for what Bell has been doing recently that, you know, your ARPU growth has exceeded your peers. You did 5% in the first quarter. And only, as you said, only 50% of that was driven by roaming. Can you talk about that other 50? How are you getting such good ARPU growth?
Well, one thing you've heard us talk about before, yes, we are getting a bit of a tailwind from roaming. We exited Q1 with about 78% of 2019 roaming levels, so we are seeing the recovery. I don't even think we will have full recovery in calendar 22, to be honest, business travel. A little slower coming back, but I would anticipate that roaming revenues in 23 will exceed roaming revenues in 2019. So we have continued tailwind, albeit maybe not as much as we enjoyed in Q1. The remainder of the ARPU growth is really focusing on high value customers. So at one time, you know, there was a lot of net adds that were focused on tablets, and they're extremely low ARPU. We don't have those in our numbers anymore. We're not focused on tablets. But the other thing was, there was a lot of focus on the value brands. And one thing that Merkel has really pushed inside our organization is to ensure that we are selling our highest value brand as well, Bell, not just Virgin and not just prepaid. Prepaid and Virgin play an important role in customer migration, introducing them into the prepaid world and migrating them into Virgin or Bell. But we can't, for lack of a better word, get lazy and sell the low value, cheaper plans. We have to focus on delivering high value plans to our customers. You're starting to see the differentiation happening in pricing with the unlimited ultimate plans, where we're selling the 4G versus 5G differentiation in the plans, and that's delivering very strong ARPU. So I think this continues as an industry if we stay disciplined and we differentiate the price plans of 4G versus 5G. And the final piece to that, Vince, is that the industry has been, promotional activity has been pretty good, and that helps when we all aren't out there misbehaving or getting silly as we chase net adds in any given quarter.
Do you have confidence that continues once there's a potential new owner of a wireless carrier in Canada, or has this been just a temporary phenomenon on the promotional front?
You know, promotional activity seems to rear its ugly head every year between around Black Friday and around Boxing Day, so I'm not going to say that this is permanent in nature. But again, I'll go back to the comment I made earlier. If a new player enters this market with a sizable acquisition and a balance sheet they need to manage, then they have to drive growth in their ARPU as well.
Now, churn has been remarkably low for everybody and trending in the right direction. Bell's, you know, doing a great job on that front as well. Is that a function of the competitive and promotional environment, or is there something else going on there that's more sustainable in terms of base management and keeping churn low that the carriers have all figured out how to do better?
I think, yeah, the short answer, yes. Vince, I do believe the lower promotional activity is benefiting everybody. You see it in all of our churn numbers. But the other thing that's transpiring is the introduction of installment plans. And this has changed consumer behavior materially. Let me unpack that and explain what I mean. Historically, when we were at a subsidized packages, what would happen is on the 25th month, the consumer would be eligible for an upgrade and in all likelihood come in and got their free upgrade. And that allowed customers to upgrade to new devices on a more frequent basis. Fast forward to today and it's installment plans. And on month 25, your bill actually goes down $40 or $50 a month because you're no longer amortizing the cost of the handset over a 24-month period. And I think what's transpiring is consumers are looking at their device and they're saying, this is pretty good. I don't know that I want to introduce myself to a $50 a month additional charge. My device is adequate. I don't see any of the new devices hitting the market with attributes that are so different or so compelling that I need to spend $1,200 or $1,500 to upgrade my phone. So the average duration handset upgrades is now pushing 35, 36 months, which is leading to lower activity in the market, which leads to lower churn. Now, you have to be careful on this because that means that we have a larger proportion of our customers that are not under contract. So that they have the ability to easily churn. But I think we've proven that if you deliver good services and decent pricing and world-class networks that you can lower your churn. And now the final point I'll make on that I think specific to BCE is our CCTS complaints, our consumer complaints are down 36% year over year. They're down 13%. Our share of CCTS complaints is down 13% this year, and that's 7 consecutive years that our share of CCTS complaints have dropped. Bottom line is it's not rocket science to anybody in this room. You know that good service is going to lead to customer loyalty and they're going to stay with us and it's starting to show up in our churn numbers.
Great. We're getting down to a few minutes left here, so move on to a different segment. And it's not one I hear you get asked about very often, but it's called at the intersection of wireline and wireless is your satellite business. And it's been pretty choppy road, if we can call it that, in the past 10 years. I think at the peak from the peak in 2011 to today, your retail customer base has basically been cut in half to 832,000 satellite subs. Are we finally getting to a point where this plateaus and these are just purely rural customers with no other option for video and may stick with it? Or is it the opposite, that all these fiber buildouts in rural areas are going to lead to an even bigger pace of erosion of satellite?
It's somewhere in between, Vince. It's not going to accelerate. I do believe we're reaching that point where there is going to be a need for satellite video delivery in this country for many, many years to come. Unfortunately, we're a huge geographical landmass, and there's areas that it will just never make sense, even with government subsidies, to get fiber to some of these areas. So without fiber, your ability to deliver quality video is limited. So there will be an area of this country that I think will still be competitive and have, a sizable number of satellite customers. That said, we continue to roll out fiber and government partnerships continue to roll out fiber in this country. And I don't think you've seen, I wouldn't say we've plateaued. I think we've slowed. That the rate of subscriber decline is starting to slow, but I would say we'll still face it for the foreseeable future. I think the good news is that the business continues to generate quite a bit of cash flow, and I think we just have to manage the pace of that decline. But when we roll out fiber, as long as we're winning that customer, I'm not as fussed whether they're paying us a TV subscription via a fiber product or a satellite product, and that's what's happening. A lot of it is self-cannibalization.
Even if it's self-cannibalization, at some point, Does the cost structure become an issue to have two satellite players in the country, with both with a diminishing subscriber base? And maybe you can refresh us and update us on how long your lease contracts go with Telesat these days. Like, when do decisions have to be made on whether to re-up the ante on long-term leases versus maybe trying to consolidate?
Yeah. Look, first off, I wouldn't see a consolidation of the satellite players in Canada being something we're actively pursuing. Completely two different platforms, two different in-home equipment, consumer equipment in the home would result in, I think, inefficiency in the beginning versus efficiency. But your point on satellites and cost structure is a valid one. Like, I think, you know, in the coming years, 3 to 5 years, you know, we're going to have to make a decision whether, you know, you need two satellites in the sky. Can you go to one? Can you have a joint satellite partnership with another provider to find efficiencies? And I think the answer to all of that is yes, yes, and yes. You have to explore that, Vince, because you're going to get down to a subscriber base that is relatively small. And the only way to maintain adequate and margins is to go after costs, and your big ones are going to be your satellite costs.
Fair enough. Last 2 or 3 minutes, let's switch to your smallest division in media. Even though you're the largest media player in the country, it's still relatively small for you guys. Is there anything you're starting to see that would concern you about a pending recession? I mean, cutbacks in advertising revenue seems to be an early area of that gets cut if businesses start to be worried about consumer spending. Is there anything in the ad bookings or outlook for Bell Media that would scare you on that front at this point?
I wouldn't say scare me. The general advertising environment has been quite healthy. We're seeing great growth in digital advertising. Put it in perspective, it represented 17% of our ad revenue a year ago, and it's 27% of our ad revenue this year. You think about the opportunity that exists for Bell Media. This is a digital ad spend in this country is $20 billion a year, and it obviously was not an area we played a significant role in historically, where all of our advertising came more from linear platforms. So we see a great opportunity there. You know, another note, though, I would say the out-of-home advertising, Vince, and radio advertising has been pretty elusive recovery. I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm disappointed with the pace of recovery there. You know, you just feel like you're gaining your momentum and people are starting to move again in Q1. And then, of course, you know, Omicron hits and people are back home. And when people aren't moving, ad revenue is difficult in the out of home space with the large billboards, and it's difficult in the radio space. So, you know, I would say there's a headwind we continue to face. It's that recovery. Really excited about what the digital world can mean for us in the next 3 years. So I'm not seeing a recession, but not without our challenges.
Can I ask, Liz, the last question I'll ask then, because we're almost out of time. When you say digital going from 17% up to 27%, can you just tell us what you include in digital? Does that include your audience based buying, the SAM platform?
Yes.
That you guys have? That does include,
it does include that.
So it's more new targeted advertising as well as anything that's actually sold on a digital, like, streaming platform or website.
Yeah, TSN,
Direct
or CTV AVOD or Crave. But we're trying to be able to deliver a one-stop shop to advertisers who come to us and say, we have the largest megaphone in Canada of media assets, bar none. And if you wish to advertise with us, we can cover the gamut of from radio to out of home to linear TV to the largest sports broadcaster in this country to also having, you know, the Crave and all of the other digital assets we have. And we're trying to use our SAM tool to be able to give, you know, the full suite of products to our advertisers. And it's really starting to gain traction, Vince.
Excellent. Well, on that note, we've just run out of our time. Glenn, fantastic to see you again in person, and thanks for your insights as always. So thanks very much, BC, for being here, and there'll be no break right now. We'll just switch presenters on stage and switch the microphone. But Glenn, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Vince, and thank you.